You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Tracy Ross.
And I'm Rebecca Vallis.
Last week, the deaths of two black men, Philando Castile and Alton Sterling, at the hands of police officers, followed by the shootings of five Dallas police officers, have reignited the national conversation around policing, the Black Lives Matter movement, and gun violence in the U.S.
To discuss the impact of these events on our country moving forward, we're joined by Jamil Smith, senior national correspondent for MTV News. He recently wrote a piece titled How to Survive in America on being black in the United States and the need to, quote, police the police. Jamil, thank you so much for joining us for Talk Poverty Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So obviously, the past week, I think, has been a particularly difficult one for black people in America and black men specifically. And you know, in your piece, you wrote that black folks born here learned this a long time ago. From childhood, we're trained in respectability politics to improve our odds of survival. There were your piece talks a lot about the politics and policies, but it's also there's some personal reflections in it. Can you share with us kind of, I guess, what the past week has meant for you as a black man?
Well, I'll start with a call I had with my father the morning after Alton Sterling's death. I'm from Cleveland, born and raised, and I'm going home for the Republican National Convention next week. And my father, for the very first time, expressed some reticence about me coming home, about me actually, you know, covering the expected melees and protests and everything else that's, you know, people, you know, are anticipating. And he expressed to me, you know, that it's simply he just didn't feel like it was safe, frankly, to be around not just the protesters, not the expected, you know, conflicts between neo-Nazis or whomever is coming to this convention. No, he was worried about the police. And in Cleveland, of course, that's a valid worry. That's something that, you know, a lot of people are concerned about in the wake of Tamir Rice's death a couple of years ago, as well as the consent decree that the city is under with the federal government to improve and rid itself of corruption. I get where his concerns were coming from, and it's a similar thing I heard from my mother after the George Zimmerman verdict. I think there's a natural urge for parents in particular to reach out to their children who they see as vulnerable in a world that frankly, you know, does not protect them equally, you know, according to the law. So I get where he was coming from, but the best I could tell him was, Dad, I'm going to do the best that I can. Because there's nothing you can do necessarily, as Philando Castile's death proves in particular. There's nothing you can do to prevent police being violent upon you. They're visiting violence upon you. There is nothing you can do to stop a cop from shooting you or abusing you or harassing you if that's what that cop wants to do. The point of my column was to put the onus back on the police to be the ones who need to be told how to, let me rephrase, the police are the ones who need to be told how to behave, not us. You know, all our lives we've been trained how to act around the police, how to address the police when we're approached, all this stuff. And frankly, we've been ignoring how the police have been behaving towards us. We've been giving them a pass. And I think in light of Philando Castile's death, I think finally they have the perfect victim that they've been always looking for. Here's a young man who was working, had never been in trouble, and had a gun on him for protection. He had a concealed carry permit. Informed the officer that he had the permit and that he was not going to be reaching for his weapon and still was shot to death. And, you know, thank goodness that his girlfriend, Diamond Reynolds, had the courage and the fortitude and the stamina to shoot that, to photograph it for the world so that we could see what was happening to him in real time. And as painful as it is to watch, I think it's inherently necessary for us to confront just how casually, you know, how cavalier these police officers are with our lives. Now, obviously, not all police officers are like that. But frankly, we need them to get as angry as we are about the state of policing in America. And frankly, how, you know, frankly, illegitimate the police are in several neighborhoods throughout this country.
I do have to just stop for a moment and recognize what you were saying about Diamond Reynolds, Philando Castile's girlfriend, because it really was remarkable. If you watch the video, which you know it's extremely hard to watch. It's one of the worst videos of this sort of incident. But the fact that her last moments with her partner, instead of comforting him, she's working to prepare a case for his justice. And you can hear the calm in her voice and the fear in the officer's voice. And it just, I think it says so much that she, again, it wasn't able to just be with him, hold his hand. She was preparing his case to defend him.
Exactly. And, we there's a certain instinct that's now being built up in this, you know, this generation that's coming up now in the age of social media, that, hey, not only do I have to beware of this kind of violence, but I have to be prepared to document it. I have to be prepared to make media of it so that others will believe my story. Because we know that, you know, when it's he said, she said in the courtroom, when it comes to police officers versus black citizens, frankly, even with video, it's always, you know, it's never really, you know, a contest. You have the cops coming out on top pretty much in every case. So I think at the very least, in the court of public opinion, you can prepare those documents that will live on forever and that will, frankly, put a stain on policing in America, the stain that, frankly, black folks have known is there for a very long time.
You mentioned your father's concern, but of course the very real and very rational concern that your father expressed to you is felt much more pervasively throughout communities of color. And it's not restricted to black folks in the United States. You actually point out in your column from earlier this week that the Bahamas felt that because it has a nearly all black citizenry, they needed to warn their citizens. You point out how, you know, countries typically will give travel advisories that might focus on extreme weather events or military conflict. But what the Bahamas actually informed its citizens was, and I feel that it's actually worth reading a portion of this, they put out a statement that read, "We wish to advise all Bahamians traveling to the U.S., but especially to the affected cities to exercise appropriate caution generally. In particular, young males are asked to exercise extreme caution in their interactions with the police." They're literally sending a message to their citizens that American police are a threat to them. Can you talk a little bit about the significance of that and whether there is precedent for that type of message being sent to a country that has a particular type of citizenry?
Yes. I'd say 6 years ago, when law was passed in Arizona, with regard to anti-immigration laws passed in Arizona, Mexico sent a travel advisory to its citizens, telling them to beware of travel to that particular state, which is understandable given the crackdown on immigration and also the sort of the more, you know, virulent cultural opinions that kind of law can unleash. But my point, you know, with regards to this, though, I haven't seen one that advised black people not, you know, to beware no matter where they go in America. You know what I mean? It's not saying, hey, if you go to Mississippi or Alabama, you know, be careful because they still have some remnants of Jim Crow. No, it's beware all of America. Be careful and make sure, as they say in the statement, do not be confrontational and cooperate. So, I mean, that to me is, you know, is troubling for a number of reasons. Number one, obviously, it's alarming that a country feels the need to alert its citizens about our own law enforcement potentially, either harming them or harassing them. But also, frankly, we shouldn't have to be the ones who are warned about our behavior. We shouldn't be the ones that are told, say, hey, make sure that you sit up straight. Be quiet. Address them with respect. Make sure that you keep your hands on the steering wheel. All these things that we're told to, you know, basically keep us alive. Philando Castile did all of that. You know what I mean? And in another way, we're also told in this country to have guns. Make sure that you protect yourself with a gun because that's the American way.
Yeah, the way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun, right?
Exactly. And that's what Alton Sterling, who was just trying to sell his CDs in front of that store, was trying to do. He's trying to make sure he wasn't getting mugged, according to a friend. And so what do you do if you don't want to get mugged in North Baton Rouge? Maybe you get a gun.
So I wanna,
that's what you're told to do. And that's what ended up accelerating the conflict towards his eventual murder.
So I want to unpack some of that, because you brought up the point again of what can Black men and women do differently in these sorts of situations. And you wrote in your piece, I tremble to think of how much time was wasted last week by the media and the public alike discussing what Sterling and Castile could have done differently. How about the officers who killed them? So in this, you kind of indict the media as well. And so as a member of the media, but as someone who also critiques the media, what do you think is getting lost in this, especially because there's this other layer of the fact that five police officers were killed and it's being linked by some people to the Black Lives Matter movement? What do you think the role of the media is in sussing out all of these issues?
The media, frankly, has to take the police out of the center of the conversation. They have to put the victims at the center. And I think, frankly, take a second to really understand what that victim may have been going through, not just in that particular moment, in that particular interaction, but look at the whole history of policing in this country and understand why there is a deep mistrust, angst between, let me put it another way. A very, very contentious relationship between African-American communities and the police. So what I think really, I think you have a largely white media structure, essentially not being able to relate to that experience. Now, they're able to, lament the fact that, Philando Castile or Alton Sterling were killed. This is a bad thing. This is newsworthy. We can put it on TV. We know people are going to watch it. But immediately we turn to the character of the victim as opposed to the characters of those who killed them. Let's talk about those police officers. Let's talk about what their fears were. Let's talk about why their, why they were, put in that position to actually have a weapon on Philando Castile and Alton Sterling, why they made the decision to pull the trigger. That, to me, is a more central question than whether or not Alton Sterling had, committed a crime in the past, or whether Philando Castile was a good guy. All these kind of different things we fill out to tell a story throughout the media really, at the end of the day, don't attack the central issues at hand, which are white supremacy and the role of the police in maintaining it.
Well, and I found myself throughout the voraciously kind of reading, probably more than was healthy of and watching what was being covered the last couple of weeks, noticing and really, at some points even throwing things at the phone or the computer or the TV as people would highlight either, someone with a criminal record. I mean, it was said over and over again, right? Philando Castile was actually painted as someone who had, quote, extensive interactions with law enforcement because he had been pulled over 31 times by some accounts by the cops for really minor stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
It felt to me not only like a just such a stark reminder of sort of the deserving and undeserving narrative and how that plays out, not just within welfare policy and conversations, but also within the criminal justice system. Who is it that deserves to live, deserves to die, and so forth? But it also felt to me to be so incredibly divorced from the turning point that we have not just reached but passed when it comes to the share of our country that has interacted with law enforcement because of four decades of mass incarceration and over-criminalization. When one in three people in this country has some type of criminal record, how can you paint those who don't have any kind of criminal record as substantially more deserving? And I'm curious what you think about that.
Yeah, I think, certainly attention needs to be paid how cavalier police are as far as introducing African-Americans to the justice system. Pulling someone over for a broken taillight, there should be no circumstance whatsoever where a weapon should be drawn. I mean, that, let's talk about, like, everyone's all, Philando, you know, he didn't do anything wrong, and he told the cop he had a gun, da-da-da-da. Why was there a gun drawn in the first place? Why did that officer have an instinct to pull his weapon? And so my thought is, we have to have a conversation not just about police brutality, but about the mass incarceration and, frankly, you know, what's driving that. You know, the easy introduction of certain people in this country to a justice system that is built to, you know, basically have them at a loss is frankly something that goes under discussed. We get caught up in the blood and the carnage in the video, but we do not talk about the larger systemic issues at hand.
One thing that's been, I guess, particularly frustrating for me over the past week is the mischaracterization of the Black Lives Matter movement. Obviously, social media is not a proper polling of people across the U.S., but even
what
just...
What was your end, Tracy?
but even just being on Facebook, where I have closer connections to people than maybe Twitter, seeing right. people's relatives talking about how Black Lives Matter is a terrorist organization, those sorts of things, especially because of what happened in Dallas. What do you think is the future of the Black Lives Matter movement emerging out of the past week?
I mean, I think that obviously what happened in Dallas needs to be unequivocally said was tragic and horrifying. And the idea, though, that somehow Black Lives Matter was behind that is asinine. And I think it's something that, frankly, you know, a lot of people could not wait to make this somehow about Black people who have been peacefully protesting for their rights and for the rights of others, including myself, to make them look like they're somehow Al-Qaeda or ISIS or the KKK. Let's talk about what a terrorist organization does. A terrorist organization uses violence to convey a certain political message or intimidate others from conveying theirs. So what exactly has Black Lives Matter done that has either taken a life or has intimidated others from speaking out? There's nothing about saying that Black lives have been disregarded and that they should be counted in this country and valued equally. There's nothing about that message that threatens white people. But yet, somehow, a lot of them take it as a threat. They take it as a threat to an America in which they are not at the center anymore. A browning America, an America that eventually, I hate this term, but I'm going to use it, it's going to become a majority-minority country. And, you know, frankly, they see the America or their idea of America disappearing. And part of that is the idea that they have to make sure that other people who don't look like them, including Black people, get the same rights and are treated equally under the law. That notion to them is un-American. And frankly, in a way, they're kind of right, because America was founded on inequality between the sexes, between the races, between different cultures, different ethnicities. All these things are inherent to what America is, to the idea of America. So if we're, you know, the idea is changing, thankfully, and some people thought that the election of President Obama was the final signifier of that change instead of the beginning of it. But I think that what you see here is a rush for people to, you know, make sure that, like, they don't have to talk about Alton Sterling or Philando Castile anymore. What the murder of the five Dallas police officers did was distract, you know, frankly, a large segment of this population from the systemic issues at hand that contributed to the deaths of Sterling and Castile. And, you know, if they cared about them at all, they certainly didn't have an excuse. They had an excuse to no longer care about them. And that's really unfortunate. And this is why whenever there's a shooting on the news, unfortunately, I have this instinct saying, please don't be Black, please don't be Black, please don't be Black. And then when he's Black, not only Black, but in a dashiki, raising a fist, I'm like, oh,
I was about to get
man.
To that because actually I didn't sleep that night because every hour on that I would wake up and I went to Twitter just hoping that we was going to find that the identity of the shooter was not black, because I think we all predicted the fallout that was going mm-hmm. to happen. And actually something I was struck by in your piece is that you referred to him as an Army Reserve veteran, whereas mm-hmm. the initial narrative was this, you know, a black power radical with mm-hmm. the dashiki, that some people even calling him, you know, Micah X Johnson, or, you know, trying right. to really convey this thing of this militant, when it's like his middle name is Xavier. He's not, they're trying to paint this, you know, Malcolm X violent figure.
And that wasn't just people on Twitter. I mean, most of the mainstream news outlets started reporting him when he was identified as Micah X Johnson.
Right.
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 Which it was hard right. not to see
and
that
ever in his military uniform, yeah. or even the fact yeah. that he criticized the Black Lives Matter movement.
Sorry, we'll let you talk, Jamil. I had you on the show yeah. for a reason.
I mean, I feel like when it comes to, you know, an assassin in the United States always seems to have three names. We have to make sure that, like, no, you know, of course, that no other Micah Johnsons are implicated. But at the same time, the fact that, you know, yeah, he had a middle initial X, it just was an unfortunate coincidence. And people ran with it, and people want to, you know, I mean, when you're talking about racism, you're not talking about inherently intelligent people purveying that kind of stuff. Racism inherently is based in ignorance. It's the opposite of intelligence. And so, you know, when you see that kind of stuff crop up, of course it's going to be pushed out by people who don't have enough information, who don't want you to have enough information. So my hope is that people can, you know, by this time, see through those tricks and understand that, you know, frankly, there are people out here with an agenda to, you know, to either disregard or end black lives. And I just don't understand why you would side with them, especially if, you know, you're, say, you know, black Republican or another Republican of color. These are the people who literally are working to, you know, let me just say this. I'll back away from that.
Always welcome to back away.
yeah. Let me just say this. I think that if you are a person of color and you see, you know, someone on your ideological spectrum, say you're conservative or even if not, you see people, you know, a particular ideological spectrum actively disregarding your pleas for recognition, for your pleas of saying, hey, I matter. My life matters. I'm here and I deserve equal treatment and protection under the law. I mean, you really have to question, you know, what public does that, you know, particular politician or official want to actually serve? If you become a policeman, you swear an oath to protect everyone, not just pick and choose who you want to protect. And so I think what we need to do is really get at the heart of what really American policing has become and how it needs to change.
So you point out in your column, and I was really glad that you drew this connection because it feels like it's been missing from a lot of the discussions around the horrible events from the last week or a couple of weeks at this point, but that at the core of all of this, in addition to racism, is guns. You point out guns spurred everything that happened last week, including the murders of five police officers, but also the police-involved killings. And I'm curious if you could look into your famed crystal ball, Jamil, and maybe help us speculate a little bit about looking ahead, not just what we see as the future of Black Lives Matter, but given some of the divisiveness, the Black Lives Matter versus Blue Lives Matter dichotomy that really appeared and resonated in a lot of the press framing of the last couple of weeks, but coupled with the ongoing and increasingly polarized conversation around gun violence prevention in this country, which often is a very white dominated discussion, but in which in recent months has broadened after Orlando to include a lot of LGBT folks. And I'm curious if you see these movements converging at all and what that means for the future of potential policy change.
I see definitely gun control, or at least, you know, some kind of gun limitation being a key element of Black Lives Matter advocacy going forward, but I think it's always really been there. I mean, frankly, people think about Black Lives Matter only in the context of the shootings that happen there periodically, you know, that involve police. But really, Black Lives Matter is on the ground, you know, and also other Black liberation groups that are associated with it. They're on the ground fighting to protect neighborhoods from, you know, predators who are living amongst us, you know, predators who may very well look like us, as, you know, so many folks are really ready and willing to point out whenever there's a police-involved shooting. You know, folks like Rudy Giuliani always come out of the woodwork to remind us how many Black people are killed by Black people.
What about Black-on-Black crime? It's always
right.
The debate, yeah.
And if, you know, we could offer back to him that 82% of white people are killed by other white people. So, you know, really, murder and urban violence is about proximity. It is not about, you know, racial self-hatred or any kind of, you know, racial superiority one over the other. We're looking at a problem of gun violence, frankly, that our Congress has been unwilling to address, unwilling to even let the president study as a public health issue, which it is. It's a public health issue like any pandemic. And so, frankly, I think what you'll see here coming out of these two deaths, hopefully, is these movements truly focusing on, you know, getting, you know, pushing for gun reforms that make sense for the communities that they serve. You know what I mean? Gun reforms that are inclusive, intersectional, and certainly do not simply address, you know, assault weapons, you know, assault weapons used in, you know, mass shootings and whatnot that, you know, that seem like they happen every day, but are not nearly as frequent as the shootings that are happening in our cities, in Cleveland, Chicago, St. Louis, Detroit. And so what I'm hoping is that, you know, the conversation about gun control can be pivoted a little bit by these groups towards more, you know, conversation about what's happening in urban neighborhoods, not simply around like, hey, don't kill each other, but hey, you know, maybe if there were some gun control here, maybe we wouldn't have all this death, period. Let's look at the systemic causes of that death, not simply the trigger men involved.
And while we're, you know, guess digging into some of these systemic issues, there was an interesting conversation that wasn't to the center of the debate, but there were a lot of people pointing out the racial double standard of the quote-unquote side hustle, that we praise young white people for being entrepreneurial, but when you saw, you know, Alton Sterling selling CDs or Eric Garner selling loose cigarettes, that became criminal. Emily Badger from The Washington Post actually, I think, explained this probably best. And she wrote that the larger cruelty is that by excluding certain communities from the formal economy, society has pushed people who might prefer legal work into underground alternatives. She continues that for men like Garner and Sterling, the very act of hustling then compounds these same problems. These last-ditch job prospects born out of unemployment can lead to arrests and criminal records.
Right.
Given the fact that these men, you know, Garner and Sterling in particular, and there have, you know, been other examples, probably many we don't even know, where they're trying to essentially make money for their family, but it's labeled criminal behavior. What do you think are the policies or the conversations we need to be having, rather, about some of these underlying socioeconomic problems that are essentially criminalizing Black people for issues that have been barriers that have been put in their place years before these instances happen?
I say, you know, I think Emily hits on an important point in her piece when she talks about the debate over broken windows policing. Broken windows policing, of course, is this tactic that is, you know, favored by New York Police Commissioner Bill Bratton and before him, you know, Mayor Rudy Giuliani and Mike Bloomberg. And basically that it's about like attacking lower level crimes, turnstile jumping and selling CDs without permit and all this other kind of stuff, you know, in the hopes that you'll be stopping larger problems. So, you know, address the broken windows before the house burns down, essentially. It's a policy that inherently is going to target people who have been shut out of the conventional economy, either by the fact that they are, you know, have a criminal record prior to seeking a job, or the fact that, you know, frankly, unemployment in African American community is exponentially higher, usually, than it is amongst whites. So when you talk about, you know, the fact that black people, a lot of black people can't find a job, you got to provide for your family, you got to provide for yourself. You're doing something by selling Lucy's or selling CDs or, you know, whatever you're selling, you know, as long as it's not drugs, I mean, what's the harm in it? I just frankly, I remember, I don't know, personally, growing up black, you know, you go to the barbershop every 2 weeks and you see a guy selling socks, you see a guy selling bean pies, you see a guy selling CDs, movies, all this stuff. And he's got, like, guys selling movies, got a DVD player so he can show you that it's, that it's not a blank DVD that he's selling you. He's selling you the real genuine article. I mean, frankly, that's part of the charm of the community. I mean, that's part of the fabric of the community. And Alton Sterling was a guy who had, you know, done wrong earlier in his life, but was obviously trying to turn his life around and trying to do the best to provide for his family, for his sons. And so the idea that that is somehow makes him like a lesser person, I just don't see how that's any different than when you see, you know, if a white guy were trying to do the same thing. I mean, gosh, I remember when we were kids, people in my high school would sell blow pops when, you know what I mean? It just, no one was getting busted for these kinds of things.
It also sets up a vicious cycle, right? Because,
right.
I mean, related to, and you know, in the last minute and a half that we have with you, it feels also so inextricably linked to the phenomenon of offender-funded justice. Fines and fees. This made national news, of course, in Ferguson, but had been happening across the country long before that. You and I have had conversations about the epidemic of fines and fees in Philadelphia, which predated all of the Ferguson attention.
Right.
But really, in addition to the broken windows theory of policing, right, and cracking down on low-level offenses in an effort for broader public safety, there is also this financial imperative that's placed on law enforcement divisions, that you got to go out and eat what you kill, which then ends up with what we've seen taking to its most tragic conclusion in Philando Castile, being shot because he was pulled over for a broken taillight.
Right. And I mean, and as somebody, you know, who's been pulled over for a broken taillight before in his life, you know, just the very notion of what happened to him is utterly, utterly, it's worse than a horror movie. It's utterly horrifying. And so when you talk about this offender, you know, the fines and fees, it's all part of this larger system that needs to be corrected. And frankly, it's not going to be corrected until enough white people, I'll be perfectly frank, get upset enough that they demand the same change that people in the Black Lives Matter movement and other black liberation movements are demanding. It just won't happen unless everyone gets as upset as they should be about how unjust this criminal justice system is, and how imbalanced it is, and how tilted it is against African Americans and other people of color. So, to conclude, I just think that, you know, when you look at these two particular cases, you have, as I wrote in the column, two instances of guys who did, frankly, what they were told to do in order to protect themselves, in order to survive. You had Alton Sterling getting a gun, as the NRA tells us to do, to protect ourselves from this terrible world that we live in. And you had Philando Castile telling the officer everything he needed to know, respectability on display, and still both of them are dead. And so I just think that, you know, it raises a lot of important questions, and I've yet to see, unfortunately, the political will from our elected officials and our candidates that tells me that anything will change anytime soon. I mean, for right now, it's enough that they are in favor of changing what's going on. But really, everyone is so disillusioned, so cynical, that no one actually believes that change can actually happen. And we need to get past that, need to really rethink how we're approaching making this change, and hopefully somebody will, you know, push something through, because this needs to stop. We don't need any more of this. We've seen enough, literally on video, in audio, you know, through audio. We've heard and seen enough of this death. We need some people to, you know, start doing something about it.
Jamil Smith is senior national correspondent for MTV News. You can find his article, How to Survive in America, at mtv.com/news. And Tracy, what else do we have coming up in this episode?
Well, we're continuing our summer book series with an interview that I did with Shaka Singor, who's the author of the New York Times bestselling book, Righting My Wrongs, Life, Death, and Redemption in an American Prison. So stay tuned for that.
And Jamil, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrel from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Tracy Ross. Over the past four decades, the U.S. prison population has exploded. While the United States makes up less than 5% of the world's population, almost 25% of the world's total prison population is in this country. To discuss the effects of mass incarceration, we're joined by Shaka Singor, an author, mentor, motivational speaker, and director of strategy and innovation for Cut 50, a bipartisan effort to reduce America's incarcerated population by 50% over the next decade. Shaka is also the author of the New York Times bestselling book, Righting My Wrongs, Life, Death, and Redemption in an American Prison, which chronicles his nearly 20 years in prison for second-degree murder. Thank you so much for joining the program, Shaka.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
So it took me nearly, I felt like 5 minutes to go through and read all of your accomplishments. I would love to just, you know, before we dive into the book and your story, hear a bit about what you're doing with Cut 50.
Well, with Cut 50, I've been, given the privilege and honor to work with some amazing people, including Van Jones, Jessica Jackson, and Matt Haney. We've been able to work on, you know, kind of pushing some legislation forward to help reduce the prison population. And my role within that organization was to help humanize the issue. I have now pivoted to a new initiative that's, you know, an extension of the work at Cut 50 called Beyond Prisons, where I'm the president and co-founder. And we'll be still working in collaboration with Cut 50.
And so a lot of this work, you said, you know, you want to put a human face on the prison population, and you're doing that through your work, but you're also doing that through sharing your own story, and which, you know, gets us to this book. But, you know, I would like to hear a little bit about your background and what it was like growing up in Detroit for you.
Yeah, so it's really important in terms of the work that I do to help people understand that behind bars are not just numbers. There's men, women, you know, mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers, sons and daughters. And I really wanted to help bring that point home through my own narrative. So I grew up in the city of Detroit on the east side. At the time, it was considered a pretty nice working middle-class neighborhood. And on the outside of our household looking in, it looked like we were the model for black middle class America. Unfortunately, there were some abuse issues at home. And eventually I decided to run away from that abusive environment. And that's how I got kind of seduced into the street culture and drug culture.
And what happened when you were 19 that landed you behind bars?
When I was 19, I probably would have to take you back just a little bit. You know, getting caught up in the street culture at the age of 14, I started experiencing all of the horrors that come with that culture, from high levels of gun violence. Both of my brothers have been shot. My one brother's been shot twice. He's currently paralyzed. And then I myself was shot at the age of 17. And 16 months after that, I got into a similar conflict that I was shot in initially. And that conflict escalated into me firing what turned out to be 4 fatal shots and tragically caused a man's death, for which I was subsequently sentenced to 17 and 40 years in prison.
And you wrote in your book that you, because you had been shot, you started carrying a gun around with you, that you were essentially, because you were a victim of violence, you became, frankly, a bit paranoid that it could happen again, that it sounded like you essentially suffered trauma. Is that correct?
Yeah, and so the reality of, and I really want people to really understand that in order to break the cycle of violence, we have to understand why it exists and how it came to be. And typically hurt people hurt people. And what I found, you know, and through my work and through my own life experience is that most of the young men who I knew who were perpetrators of gun violence were at some point victims of gun violence or in close proximity to it at a very, very early age. And when I got shot, I didn't know how to process all of those emotions, the paranoia, the anger, the sadness, the fear. And I reacted based on the you know, standards that were set in the hood, you know, which was to carry a gun so that I could protect myself and ensure that I wasn't a victim again. And sadly and unfortunately, that led to me being a perpetrator of active gun violence.
And it sounded like through what you wrote that you also didn't feel comfortable sharing your emotions, that there was not only was there no, I guess, professional help, but it was difficult to talk about you know, the PTSD that you acquired.
Yeah, I mean, there hasn't been any safe havens for young men and women who suffer high levels of gun violence in the inner city. It's just one of those things where people look at it as, you know, that's what happens in the hood and deal with it. You know, you go back to the neighborhood as a young boy trying to navigate your way through this environment, there's not many outlets for you to express what you're actually feeling inside without being vulnerable to the point of being exploited. And so, like many young men and women, I bottled up those emotions and processed them in very unhealthy ways, which was kind of self-medicating, drinking and hanging out and partying instead of just addressing what was going on inside of me.
So after the murder occurred and you were convicted and sent to prison, you started actually writing while you were behind bars. And it sounded like this eventually led to you writing this book. Why did you want to write this book and share something that is a dark part of your history?
Well, initially, I've never had plans on writing a book about my personal life. I started off writing fiction while I was in solitary confinement, and largely because literature had been a saving grace for me. Being able to read and take my mind to other worlds and challenge my thoughts and you know, mature and evolve emotionally through reading, I knew that there was an opportunity for me to engage young men and women in my community before they ended up in prison through the written word. And so I started off writing fiction because I felt like I could reach them through fiction faster than through, you know, nonfiction. And I ended up publishing books from prison and got out and sold those books. And when I would go to sell those books and talk about my story, people wanted to know more. And that's when I decided that it was really important to write the memoir, because I wanted people to understand two things. One of them is I wanted to help people understand the cycle of inner city gun violence. And the other one is that I wanted people to understand what's really happening inside our prison system and why things are so dysfunctional and why the recidivism rate is 70%. So I wanted to bring them as close proximity to prison as possible without them actually having to get arrested.
And I want to read a very short part of that's takes place, I guess it's fairly early in the book. It's in the prologue. It's a letter that you wrote to the victim, and you wrote, "I know that saying I'm sorry can never restore your life, but I believe in the power of atonement, and I've taken responsibility for my actions by dedicating my life and talents for making amends for the pain I've brought into this world." What made you want to start with, rather than, I guess, talking about some of the pain of your upbringing, you started with a letter to the victim?
Well, I thought it was really important for people to understand where I'm at today and who I am as a human being. And, you know, the book, I really wanted people to not walk away feeling like the book was excusing away my behavior or the decision I made in life, and to really understand how the lifelong impact. Like, you know, there's a lot of things you can do in life that you can repair and you can restore, but once you take someone's life, you can never restore that. And the only thing you could do is work to help others see how tragic of an experience it was and to ensure that they don't end up in a situation where they have to carry that burden for the rest of their lives. And I really wanted them to see what I feel and what I felt when I sat down to write that letter.
And now one of the, I guess, hard things to read in the book is the fact that you spent 7 years in solitary confinement. You know, this is something that President Obama essentially made outlawed for juvenile offenders. But can you reflect on what solitary confinement is like in our prison system?
Solitary confinement is torture. And it's, to me, it's one of the most shameful aspects of our society. As modern as our society is, we have not found a way to, you know, deal with mental illness inside prison in a healthy way, other than to lock people away for extended periods of time by themselves in a cell. And so my experience was like, solitary confinement was the most chaotic environment I've ever been in prison. Because the level of mental illness is shocking, and the level of abuse is overwhelming when you think about this is what's happening to men and women who at some point is going to return to society. And we have to think about what kind of men and women we want to return. Do we want healthy and whole human beings, or do we want men and women whose lives have been further shattered by their experience inside prison? And solitary confinement is designed to do just that. It's just a horrible, horrible experience. You know, you think about Khalif Browder, who was in solitary on Rikers Island for 2 years, and he got out, and he couldn't manage the emotions, the emotional trauma he experienced, and eventually committed suicide. And, you know, that's what we do to people in this country. Like, we have closed, you know, we've turned a blind eye to the, you know, the travesties that's happened in that environment. But then we had this high expectation that once men and women get home, that they should just come home and play nice and normal like everybody else, even though they've had their lives shattered and been completely traumatized.
And to that point, you said that actually in the book you write, many of the inmates in solitary confinement were not there because of violent offenses, but because of psychiatric conditions that made it difficult for them to mix in with the general population. And given the fact that, you know, actually the largest group of people, the largest marginalized group behind bars are people with disabilities,
right.
How has that informed, I guess, the work that you're doing? Obviously, you're working to cut mass incarceration down, but the fact that there's clearly a way in which our country's failing people with mental illnesses, how is this playing into your work?
Well, it's really one of the main drivers of my work. You know, when I walked out of prison, you know, I was cautioned to just get out in society, find a job, and go on about my life and act as if that 20 years didn't exist. And the reality is, you know, I grew up in there, you know, and those are my friends in there. That was my neighborhood. And to be in that environment and see what was happening to the most vulnerable people, people suffering from schizophrenia and bipolar disorders and other mental illnesses, like, I couldn't in good conscience walk out and ignore their plight and act as if I didn't see what I had witnessed. And so I knew that I had to give voice to their experience, even though it was no longer my experience. I had to give voice to that because I believe that when you're blessed with a talent and a gift, you have a responsibility that comes with that, and that responsibility is to enlighten those who may be unaware of what's happening on their watch. These are our tax dollars that pay for a broken system. And when I say broken, we have a 70% recidivism rate. Any other business model that has a 70% failure rate, people will withdraw their money. But we studied dump more and more tax dollars into this broken system, and I wanted to show people just how broken it is, and to help people understand that we are basically psychologically maiming people who are already hurt, and that we can do a better job, and we can figure out a way to decriminalize mental illness, first of all, and when those who are up under the jurisdiction of the Department of Corrections who suffer from mental illness, if they're getting quality treatment instead of just being thrown into a solitary confinement cell and left, you know, to navigate that space on their own.
So you mentioned, you know, just how difficult it was to be in solitary, how it was essentially torture. So there were obviously trying circumstances throughout your entire time in prison, but you write so eloquently about your son and how your son essentially helped create an aha moment for you because of a letter that he sent you. And, you know, I would love for you to tell us the story, tell us about your son reaching out to you. But I'd also just be interested in your take on what it means to be a parent behind bars.
So I'll respond to the first part of being a parent behind bars. It is the most difficult part of the incarceration experience because you're disconnected from children who need the nurture and guidance of their parent, their biological parents, for the most part, or their guardians. And just being in that environment and knowing that you left a child out there in society to kind of navigate the world on their own, that was very difficult. Unfortunately, I had a father who stepped in and kind of filled the gap and would bring my son up to see me and make sure that he wrote me letters. And one day he wrote a letter, and he had told me that his mother had told him why I was in prison. And when he began to express how he felt not having a father home and that, you know, basically he was seeing me through the eyes of an innocent child, and in his eyes I was a monster who had committed this heinous crime. And as a father, that was something that I just couldn't bear, living with the legacy of, you know, my son knowing me only as, you know, inmate number 219184, convicted murderer. And so I began to work diligently to turn my life around. And I had the great guidance of some amazing mentors. My mentors are all serving life sentences. But they're some of the most amazing human beings I've met because despite the fact that they know that they're going to die in prison, they poured everything they could into those of us who was coming home with the hopes that we would carry the message back to the community. And so having their guidance and having that letter and another letter from the victim's mother, godmother, really changed my life in a way that, you know, made me realize that I still could have some purpose and some meaning, that I can help young men and women in my community, and that I can help the nation as a whole really understand mass incarceration, understand what we're doing to human beings, and help to change and fix it.
And you referred to the victim's godmother in her letter, and in it she forgave you. Was that surprising for you?
It was surprising. It was very, very hard to accept. Because I wasn't in a space where I had forgiven myself. You know, I was an honor roll, scholarship student, pretty smart kid who had made a poor, horrible decision based on a chain of circumstances that were really unfortunate and sadly all too common in inner cities. And that decision made me feel like a horrible human being. And so when I got the letter from her, it took years for me to be able to accept the grace of forgiveness that she had extended to me and to finally be able to forgive myself and realize that I could make a difference in the lives of others.
And you earlier talked about how a criminal record in society can essentially be a life sentence. How do you feel like someone can truly reenter society, given the fact that on job applications, you have to indicate your criminal record. Obviously, there's a growing Ban the Box movement to address that. We have a policy called Clean Slate that tries to seal records if you haven't committed a crime after a decade. But for the most part, whether it's housing or even college or a job, you know, you have that scarlet letter with you. How can people really reenter society given how the system is currently set up?
I mean, it's very difficult, and I mean, I think it's one of the reasons we have such a high recidivism rate. I mean, when you lock people out of opportunities, you can't help but to see that they're going to return to street culture, because their street culture is always hiring. And so to get out and to know that no matter how much you want to do the right thing, that people are going to put blocks in your pathway, is very demoralizing. It's very hurtful. And I see it all the time. I saw it when I came home and I attempted to find employment and nobody would hire me through the traditional route because I had a felony. And, you know, I went through a whole thing of trying to find an apartment for my family. And because I had a felony, we couldn't rent an apartment. And that's extremely difficult for somebody coming home after two decades, because I missed the whole part of life where you build credit and you buy a home and things like that. And so coming out to an environment that's very resistant toward change and redemption, you know, it's extremely difficult, you know. And I think there's 40,000 collateral consequences of having a felony on your record, not just being in prison, but just having a felony itself. Is a great impediment toward achieving, you know, just the American dream of being able to, you know, work and take care of and provide for your family. And so those are things that we really, really have to change if we want to see a reduction in recidivism and we want to see a decrease in the prison population. We have to be willing to give people an opportunity to prove themselves worthy. And what I found in my experience, when you get somebody coming home from prison who wants to work, they're typically going to be the best workers you can hire, because they have a lot to prove. You know, we have a lot to prove. And because we want to do the right thing and we just want the opportunities that anybody else is afforded. I know in my particular case, there's so many different things that get in the way of you know, the work that I do. I travel like 3 weeks out of the month, and because I have a family, I can't get TSA approval, even though I pay probably more taxes than most American citizens pay. And so just to be a taxpaying citizen and not have the rights that come with being a citizen is extremely hurtful, but it can also be debilitating.
And we're getting to a point, it feels like, in the national conversation where people understand how just it is for people to serve lengthy sentences when it comes to nonviolent offenses. You know, as someone who is convicted of a violent offense, you know, for a second-degree murder, what do you want people to understand about violent offenders?
What I want people to understand is that 90% of men and women are coming home, regardless to whether it's violent or non-violent offense. In my experience and what data suggests is that those who have been convicted of more serious crimes are least likely to commit or reoffend when given the opportunity to reemerge in society in a way that allows them to work and go to school and things like that. And higher education also is a great indicator of a person's ability to stay out and stay free and stay out of trouble. And so I don't think it's a matter of violent versus non-violent. I just think that's a bunch of political correctness that we see run amok anytime election campaigns are going up. For whatever weird reason, they think that makes society safer to say these things. But in reality, 90% of the men and women are coming home. And we just have to make a conscious decision on what kind of men and women we want to come home and what type of structures we want to put in place to ensure that they're able to find employment and find housing and just those building blocks to life and really create a space where men and women can successfully transition. And we have all the resources available to do it. We just have to have the political fortitude and emotional will to see it through.
And your book, again, I told you before the interview, was fantastic. Are you planning on writing any more books in the future?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I love writing. Is what I do. It's the thing I'm most passionate about. I'm looking forward to returning to more fiction writing, but also will be writing a follow-up. There were a lot of questions that people had about kind of my process. You know, how did I turn my life around? What were some of the things that I learned on my experience that can be helpful and beneficial to others. So I'm looking forward to getting started on that really soon.
The book is Righting My Wrongs, Life, Death, and Redemption in an American Prison. Shaka Singora, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can catch us weekends at 11 a.m. on the We Act Radio Network. You can also catch us Saturdays, 11 a.m., and Sundays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Voices Network via the TuneIn app.
You can also subscribe to Talk Poverty Radio as a podcast via iTunes. And feel free to pitch us on Twitter at the handle @TalkPoverty or email us at info@talkpoverty.org. See you next week.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford because my block ain't safe. I spend most of my